Okay, well, after Sri's talk, I realized it's really no point spending your time doing consultation for observers. It's much better to do real pure theories. You gain everlasting fame even after you die. Right, okay. So what I want to talk about today is this project we just finished in collaboration with Phil Aras and KITP, which is the dissipation of tides in Jupiter and hopefully in a range of other similar astrophysical environment as well. So before I start, let me just define this critical quantity that I'm going to refer to huge number of times, which is this tidal Q factor. Okay, what it really is saying, let me go back to this. If you have a object and there's a point mass going around it, there's going to be a tidal bulge raised on the object, and typically this object is not frictionless, so the tidal bulge will not be pointing directly at that point mass, but will have some kind of phase lag. Okay, and let's say this is the energy in that tidal bulge, which in this case we call the equilibrium tide, because it's sort of a non-resonant response. It's just a hydrostatic response of the star to the point mass, and then we divide it by this quantity, which is amount of tidal dissipation that occurs during one tidal period. Okay, so this Q factor is dimensionless, and the larger the Q factor is, that means the smaller dissipation there is. And this is not the same as, we hear a lot about gravitational instability, it's not the same as the Tumor Q factor, although in both cases, we want the Q factor to be as small as possible. The reason we're interested in this, that any kind of time scale related to tidal dissipation, for example, tidal synchronization, tidal circularization, the time scale all go linearly proportional to the Q factor. And that's the sort of the central number I was going to talk about this talk. Okay, why do we care about this problem? There's sort of a big discrepancy between observation and theory in this tidal Q factor. In the case of Jupiter, which is sort of the most glaring contrast. If you remember from Manhoy's talk that in Jupiter, the four Galilean satellites have somewhat sort of miraculous orbital configuration in the sense that Io, Europa, and Ganymede has sort of 1:2, 1:2 orbital period ratio, which in one hypothesis, not the hypothesis that Manhoy was mainly talking about, but in the tidal evolution hypothesis, what happens is that Jupiter is rotating very fast, and Io is sort of circling it slowly. Because of tidal dissipation on Jupiter, angular momentum is deposited from Jupiter to Io, and that pushes Io outward. And when Io getting pushed outward and see Europa, it pushes Europa outward. And similar things happens when Ganymede comes in the picture, so the three things are moving out together. And from this behavior, if this hypothesis is right, that would say the Q factor of Jupiter is about 10 to the 5. And what that really means is saying, well, it's about one part in 10 to the 5 energy is dissipated per orbital, per tidal period. In fact, it's sort of funny because this number happens to be, it's about the same, if you want to connect to the real world, it's about the same order of magnitude as a sort of string you use on a violin, the steel musical string has about the same Q as this. By the way, if you look at the sort of Q of the Earth, it's about 10. So Earth is a very bad resonant cavity, while Jupiter is pretty good. Unfortunately, when you put in whatever we know about Jupiter and calculate how big the Q factor of Jupiter is, it turns out Jupiter is theoretically even much better cavity then observations say this. So this calculation is done pretty early on, but it sort of involves saying, well, there's this tidal bulge, which has a time dependencies, and if you put in the fact that Jupiter is convective, that generates some kind of turbulent viscosity, which is damping this tidal bulge, then you get Q is 10 to 13. Okay, there's a factor of 10 to the 8.
Attention, what is the x-axis?
Oh, yeah, I got this picture from it's time, sorry. Sorry? It's about giga-year time scale, I think, here. From 0 to 50. I don't remember how many giga-years in this particular. Right, and that's a semi-major axis. Okay, over the years, Well, in fact, it was a really scary thing to start working on this, because over the years, well, the problem was first posed in 1966, and it has been 40 years now almost, and over the years there have been many attempts. So different theory has been proposed. So now we come along with a new theory, and it's going to be really difficult to convince people, perhaps, that this theory is probably the right theory, although I'm pretty convinced. Okay. The reason we started working on this after 40 years, the problem is posed, is really mainly inspired by this picture. This picture is plotted as seven major axes versus eccentricity of all the known extrasolar planets that we know of now, where the sides of each extrasolar planet has a circle around it with a size proportional to the m sine I, okay? And you see sort of upper envelope to the eccentricity of this planet, which corresponds to the fact that if you put in Q is 10 to the 5 for this system, and they go around the star, the orbits will get circularized to within this envelope. Okay, so that's inspiration we got from the extrasolar planet. We thought that any theory that applies to Jupiter should also apply to this planet. And the other thing I want to mention is that while we also we're working on it, we figure out while you're working on the project inspired by this, you figure out there's other things you can learn about this for working on it. So that's the motivation. You usually think of motivation afterwards, which is saying, well, first thing is that if we can figure out how to explain the Q factor, perhaps that can lead to some sort of understanding for the interior structure of Jupiter. And the other thing is of relevance, especially mentioned quite a few times in this conference, is tidal inflation. Well, this planet has gone through quite a bit of tidal circularization. If the heat from those tidal dissipation is indeed dissipated fairly deep inside those planets, you could use them to blow them up and explain the size you see in, for example, HD20945AB. And that's one thing I'm going to come back to in my conclusion, whether that's really possible. All right. So this whole transparency just explains the philosophy behind our approach. If you can just go away remembering this philosophy. The philosophy is that, well, usually when you sort of talk about the tidal bulge, that's non-resonant. And you can't really put in that much energy in there because it's non-resonant. But in any case, if you have a resonance, you can put in a lot more energy into the system by forcing it at the resonant frequency. So tidal perturbation has periods of omega tide. If you have some global mode inside the system, which have frequency comparable to that, or even very, very close, you can put in suddenly a lot more energy in here than the equilibrium tide energy. This formula is just because I'm assuming that whatever that global mode has the energy, it has a damping ray of gamma that just came from there. So if we can find the resonance, which will solve half the problem already. And this is a list of possible modes, global modes in any fluid system you can think of. All of them sort of not possible in the case of Jupiter. For example, there's no tension, Jupiter's a fluid, there's no pressure wave resonating with the tide because they have basically dynamical frequency or higher. So they're too high in frequency compared to tide. And gravity mode does not really exist in Jupiter because you need buoyancy, while Jupiter is a fully convective system where there's zero buoyancy. So what leads us to, in the end, is a new branch of mode. Well, it's not really new, I'll show it later, but this unique branch of mode called inertial mode, which people don't talk very much about. And the interesting thing about this inertial mode is that unlike gravity modes or pressure modes, which is restored, so supported by those hydrodynamic forces, here it's restored by inertial forces, the Coriolis force. And that's another neat thing. It turns out inertial modes has a frequency which falls within this range, where omega is a rotating frequency of the body. Well, compare that with the tidal frequency for both Jupiter and extra-Jupiter. That's exactly the range of the inertial mode. So I told you there's this new branch of modes in the convective system. Let me just give you another sort of more familiar analogy. In fact, when you flew here, or when you're going to fly out tomorrow, you are experiencing inertial mode to some degree because that's just a jet wind in our atmosphere. What happened in our atmosphere is that it's still stably stratified. However, there's some pressure gradient between the equator and pole, and that drives certain fluid motion, okay? But that fluid motion is strongly affected by rotation, by Coriolis force, in the sense that the motion going this way is going to turn around, going this way is going to turn around. So we call those Rossby waves. And in this case, because it's in a stratified, stably stratified atmosphere, it's really just a motion on a thin shell, okay? Those are inertial waves, and they have this fancy name, Rossby waves. But what we're going to be concerned about is the same motion, but in a sphere, in a sort of neutrally stratified sphere. The equation you can write down for these modes are incredibly simple. This is the, well, this is the displacement of the motion. This is the inertial, sort of the acceleration term. This is the Coriolis terms. And in this case, you have compressional terms, although this term turns out typically pretty small. And in our case, we take the approach of adiabatic perturbations. So there's no heat exchanges. And that pressure perturbation is just related to everything like that. That's just mass conservation. Okay, so that's the equation. So everybody could have just gone ahead and solved those equations and solved this problem probably a long time ago, except this equation is hard to solve, okay? Typically, when you write out any kind of sort of pulsation, oscillation equation in the sphere, ends up you have a very nice situation that you can separate the variable into sort of two parts. One part is only a function of r, and the other part only a function of theta. I already removed the phi component because you can always sort that out. Okay, usually that makes this equation separate into two different equations, but each one of them is an ordinary differential equation. Everybody can solve that. Maybe not high school students, but everybody can solve it otherwise. And unfortunately, in this case, because the Coriolis force, it couples the r and theta direction so intimately that this equation is not separable. So you have to sort of either put up with a partial differential equation and use techniques like spectral methods, like Gordon and Doug have done in their paper. By the way, I'm going to mention that later too. Or you do what we do. We do it the other way, which is we adopt this incredibly powerful new technique invented by Brian in 1889. And what Brian found out through some mysterious, ingenious intellectual activity, found out that if you can decompose, well, you can sort of invent a new set of coordinates. Instead of use the r theta coordinates, which everybody uses and love, you use a new set, which is called ellipsoidal coordinates. In this case, I'm showing for a particular possibility. So this coordinate went like this, almost like a cylindrical coordinate, but with some curvature in it, so some kind of curvilinear coordinate. Then the equation becomes roughly separable, in which case we can solve ordinary differential equations again. And this is what we get for one of the inertial modes when we do such exercise. Okay. So what I'm going to show you is just one particular inertial mode, just give you some feeling that we're not talking about some unreal physical oscillation, but something you can actually visualize. What I did here is in the density profile goes like this. So it's basically n equals 1 polytrope, like what most Jupiter should be. And you see that, let's say this is the density perturbation of that inertial mode in a sort of cross-section cuts through the northern hemisphere in the cross-section. And you see these big rows, and these big rows are aligned along these coordinate lines, which is exactly those ellipsoidal coordinate lines, and also aligned the other direction. In this case, this particular mode has three quantum numbers because it's three-dimensional quantity. It's a three-dimensional global mode, so it needs three quantum numbers. The first one just adds a mu, so it's n phi, cosine n phi, so that's two. And the two other quantum numbers is 5 and 3. That means if you go along this coordinate, so we call it x1 coordinate, you can count 5 rows. If you go along this coordinate, you can count 3 rows. This is the corresponding displacement picture, or excuse me, velocity if you want, for the same mode. And you can see that what this inertial mode is doing in the interior, so we're doing these rows, so the vortex motion. inside the planet. So that's how the modes look like. I just want to point out for my later on purposes, the two features I want to concentrate on in these modes. The first feature is that, well, over most of the planet, the modes has sort of constant wavelengths everywhere, except this tiny little surface region where there's a sharp, very sharp velocity gradient. And this concentrated along a sort of strange angle, special angle, where this is the mode frequency divided by twice the spin frequency. Okay, so we call this, let me call this a singularity region, even though it's not really singularity. The other thing I want to point out is that every even inertial mode, even across the equator, sort of symmetric, they will contain this sort of Y22, which means a cosine squared theta or something like that. They will contain this component in there if you decompose them into a spherical harmonics. And what is special about this component is that this is the angular dependence of the tidal potential. Okay. Every mode, every even mode will have that. That's sort of in striking contrast with gravity waves or acoustic waves in non-rotating object, where you have a whole branch of gravity wave, but only a family of them have that component. But now everyone has. This is just another picture to show you how inertial modes look like on the surface, if you are an observer, if you're crazy enough to want to go observe it. Okay. So that's all the background you need. Now, before I present the final results in just one view graph, let me go through two view graphs to give you some kind of rationale of how do we proceed with such exercise. I said that Q is just this, and if you are in the resonance, this one energy in the mode can be sort of boosted up, just like if you're sloshing a water tank. If you're in resonance, you can sort of get a much larger sloshing amplitude. That's this. Okay, but then you want to be resonance. So I have a tidal frequency, which is this green line, happen to be here. This is the inertial mode frequency range from 0 to 2 in the units of rotational frequency. Right? How likely I'm going to be in sort of good resonance with any inertial mode? Well, this product here is that I'm plotting from, I'm adding all the N1 and N2 together. So up there is a very, very low order inertial mode, and down here it will become higher and higher order. Okay, as you go to higher and higher order inertial mode, the same sort of order is going to be distributed in here, because there are going to be more and more of them, get denser and denser, so it's much easier to find the resonance with the tidal frequency. So the rationale here is that you want to find pretty high order inertial modes, because that way you can resonate very well with tide. And the other things that singularity region I talked to you about earlier is such that for higher and higher order modes, they become smaller and smaller, a sharper and sharper velocity gradient. And as you know, viscosity likes to work on small scales. The smaller the scale is, the stronger the dissipation. And in their case, higher order modes can be damped much more strongly, and that comes into this factor. So we get both this big and this big. That's how we can reduce the factor, the Q factor, hopefully by a factor of 10 to the 8. Well, this is where the internal structure comes in. All I gave you here is sort of almost in respect of what the Jupiter actually looks like. How does the Jupiter's interior structure translate into the Q factors? This is the only place. It turns out that higher order modes couple weaker to the tide. This is pretty sort of intuitive to understand that, well, let's say this is a guitar. I was told violin is not a good example. Guitar is better. This is a guitar string. You pluck the guitar. Usually you get fundamental frequency of that string, and then you get first harmonic many times. In fact, you should, otherwise it's awful sounding. And then you get second harmonics, higher harmonics, and so on. But as you go to higher and higher harmonics, that means the waves will have more and more wiggles in this string. So the coupling between your plucking and the strings goes down. So you will not hear things like hundreds harmonics or 200 harmonics. So that's the same idea. The higher order inertial modes, because they have wiggles inside the star, so many wiggles, the coupling gets weaker and weaker. And how weak, how fast this coupling decays with more order, as I said here, depends on the how the planet looks like. So what I have here is, in the end, I'm going to show you results for three different models, the Q factors. The first model I'm going to adopt, well, actually third model, but never mind, the red one. You can see the density profile of the red one. This is 1 minus r. So this is the surface of the planet. This is the interior. This is the density in logarithmic scale of the planet. And the red one, with a little kink here, is a model from made by Tristan Gill, which took into account this effect, which may or may not be real, that around this distance, about 1 megabar in pressure, there is a phase transition of hydrogen around here, where hydrogen is changed from molecular to metallic. And in this case, this calculation, this is a first order phase transition, which means there's a density jump. Okay, that's the density jump you see there. So the second model we adopted is this blue one, which is also a model made by Tristan, and where it's not a single power law. In the interior of the planet, you mostly get sort of n equals 1 power law, like a degeneracy, degenerate object. And the exterior of the planet, you get a different power law. The transition happens around here. That's because hydrogen basically goes from ideal gas up there to Coulomb-dominated gas down here. So there's sort of a power law transition in the density profile. Okay, that's the second model. And the third model is sort of an ideal or even sort of silly model, which is just single power law. Okay. And I'm going to show you the Q factor for three different models. And you can tell for yourself that what does it tell about Jupiter's internal structure. Okay, what I show here is, again, this inertial mode frequency range. Remember, the tidal frequency falls somewhere in here, depending on which situation you're talking about. And this is the Q factor in logarithmic scale. And if you don't have any resonance, forget about inertial modes. Suppose they don't exist, you get 10 to the 13 up there. I can't even point it. Okay. This is the three models. Let me first explain sort of featuring here first. Just look at the red one, okay? There's sort of a flooring here in Q factors, sort of a flat plateau, and that's because at any frequency, any arbitrary frequency in here, you get enough high-order modes that's in resonance with you. Those high-order modes, sort of very high-order modes, make up this plateau. You cannot go any, you cannot get any worse than those. But from time to time, you hit the point one of these very, very deep valleys, and pretty shallow as well. Those are times when you're lucky and you hit upon the resonance with very low order inertial modes, okay? And the change in Q factor can be of order many orders magnitude. Interestingly, they don't matter in the sense that if you average over time, because whenever they hit into such a strong resonance, the torque on the planet is so fast, the planet just got dragged out of the resonance very quickly. The planet spent very little time in this very deep resonance, inversely proportional to how strong the torque is. So if you do a time average, those values don't really matter. What really matters is the plateau. And you can see the three models differences. First of all, the transition jump, density jump, this value is pretty close to the sort of inferred Jupiter's value. It got worse if I don't have that, and it got even worse if I just use that silly single power law. And all this can be, so we capture all this through toy models, analytical studies. And it's pretty easy to understand, just because all the Vigos in the star, when you sort of couple it to the tidal potential, it depends on how the density runs, whether there's any internal reflections, or whether there's any density discontinuity, you can change the coupling drop-off. And I just mentioned we use the turbulent viscosity here, which supposedly the correct turbulent viscosity, which is the worst scenario viscosity you could have, in a way. Okay, so I'll conclude. First is that in our model, we basically, we don't invoke any new physics in our calculation. We just say, well, Jupiter is neutrally stratified and it's rotating, so they must have this inertial mode. So in our sort of solution, you should see very many spikes in the Q factor as a function of frequency, And that's because inertial modes are fairly dense in spectra. And the other thing is that, well, I can't really point my finger to say, well, there is a first order metallic phase transition in Jupiter. I can only say if that is true, that really explains the Q factor of Jupiter. But that's going to make somebody really happy and somebody less happy. And I wish I can be more affirmative on that, except there's caveat. Okay, the caveat, the true kind of caveat, I've been discussing this a lot with Gordon and Doug, who also published a paper ahead of us. Ours haven't been published. They published a paper ahead of, on basing on the same physical mechanism, but using a different calculation, and they put in a core, a largest core. They found out they can get the same Q factor without the stuff I was hoping for. So that may be something we want to investigate more. What is the effect of a big core? A small core doesn't matter. And the other thing is that if you have a deep radiative atmosphere, perhaps that's going to change some of the conclusions we make here as well. And that applies to the case of extrasolar planet. So I want to make the next point, this point. It's perhaps a bit too hopeful to think that tidal dissipation can blow up the planet if our theory is right. Because in our case, all the tidal dissipation, 1 in 99% whatsoever, occurs in the few surface pressure scale height in that singularity region. Not only occurs very thin, very high up in the atmosphere, it's also occurring in sort of a narrow angular region. So those heat deposited there will be just gone in the months, in the 2 months sort of thermal time scale of that layer, so that you won't do much to the planet, at least not directly through tidal dissipation. So that's our prediction. But if different models like this come in, maybe that would change the conclusion. And this is what we want to do in the future. It turns out Jupiter and exo-Jupiter is not the only one that have Q about 10 to the 5. Saturn, solar type binaries, totally different objects have the similar Q. And we want to apply our theory to explain all of them. Thanks a lot.
When you have a very eccentric orbit, you're effectively summing over a large number of frequencies. And in this case, are those spikes still negligible, or do they make a substantial contribution?
Okay. If you have a very eccentric orbit, what really happens is that you have forcing frequencies at twice the omega, four times omega, six times omega. It keeps on having a sort of, you have many, many forcing frequencies. But as you can see in that plot, that's all within the two omega, sorry, that force, many of those forcing frequencies force out of the 2 omega range. So only the 2 omega range in this case is what we're considering. And you can ask, the other question, similar question you can ask is that, suppose my tidal frequency is randomly chosen, how large, how likely I get a Q factor which is incredibly small, and therefore I swipe through. Chance is pretty small. For example, if you want to have let's say this is the sort of tidal forcing frequency of Jupiter, in about in this range. And what's the chance I hit upon the Q which is so small, or this small? In which case you can say, wow, that suddenly pushed Io a large way out very quickly. And I was a bit naively hoping that could explain some of the heating, sudden heating or past heating of Europa as a function of time, something like that. But I was told by Dave that was pretty too naive. Okay, let's say how likely you can hit them on one of those deep valleys. The chance is pretty small, 10 minus 3, 10 minus 4 each. Does that help you?
Yeah, I was thinking more in the eccentricity of 0.95.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. That's outside the range. Those high frequency are outside our range. Yeah.
A couple of comments and then a question. First comment, with regards to whether the phase transition exists, that is first order, the theoretical issue is unresolved. There is an observational constraint, although it's not a clear-cut one, and that is that if you have a first-order phase transition, you must partition elements across it. That's Gibbs thermodynamics, very elementary thermodynamics. And for any reasonable phase transition of this kind, the partitioning is in the direction of putting the helium above. And of course, we don't see that. So that's one of the reasons why I think there is no first order phase transition, but I would admit that we don't know that for sure. Now, with regards to the question of a core, let me make the following observation or suggestion. It's possible that we get some guidance from Uranus and Neptune. You could think of Uranus and Neptune as being candidate structures for the central part of Jupiter and Saturn. If you believe that idea, then we have, I believe, very good evidence that Uranus and Neptune are stably stratified at depth. The argument comes from two things. It comes from the heat flow, which is lower than it should be for those bodies, and also from the recent work of Sabina Stanley and Jeremy Bloxham on the magnetic field, where they find that a stably stratified deep interior helps to get the magnetic field that we observe. So that leads to the suggestion, which is that it's really quite important in this calculation to put in a gradational transition to stable stratification rather than a brick wall. And I don't know what that does to the calculation, but that's what one should do. And that brings me also to the question of the atmosphere, because you make the point that you're getting dissipation near the surface. Now, of course, the density doesn't go to zero. I mean, you're using this density profile, which comes out of an adiabatic structure. But of course, it's not adiabatic. So the sine x upon x profile, or 1 minus r squared as you approximate it, of course is not correct near the surface. It gradationally goes into an exponential profile with stable stratification. And so, yeah, that's right. So those curves are not correct for the real Jupiter.
Yeah.
For any realistic model of Jupiter, it should go close enough to the surface. So my question is, does it matter?
Okay, let me make a not very intelligent remark to your first comment about the large core. Okay, I think what people should do is do planet modeling to see how that changes the size of planet, whether that's going to make an effect first. And if it does do a big effect, that's probably going to exclude it to some degree. Okay, that may be not very intelligent. Okay, to your second comment, you're saying, well, the convective zone in Jupiter doesn't really go to zero density. What if there's a cutoff somewhere where it becomes radiative? Okay, so the conclusion we draw from our work is that as long as that region happens above the photosphere, at least for Jupiter, that's not going to matter, because we are using high-order inertial modes. However, we are not so high in order such that they really penetrate regions so high up in Jupiter. It turns out that as long as you're about few pressure scale high below the photosphere, you're still convective. That's all we care.
Okay, but stable stratification may come in well below optical depth unity. In other words,
right.
Not that,
right.
It's only a little way off your curve.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know that for sure.
True.
But it's possible.
Just a quick comment with regard to where the heat gets deposited, whether it spreads over to different regions. Suppose you did do that over the first few scale height. There is still the possibility, well, then we go into the nonlinear regime, I assume, then the background temperature gradient would change, and there may be circulation that goes on to spread things out.
Mm-hmm.
Would you still expect a band structure, or there are calculations that Pingao has done, which puts the heat source fairly close to the top. Of course, if you put it very close to the top, there's no effect of inflation. But if you put it relatively close to the top, within a few scale height, as long as you get down to there's some magic pressure scale height, and as long as you can get down to that level, you can still puff up the top layer.
Okay, I could see the point that if you, for example, in the case of Jupiter, you deposit all your, say, negative angular momentum in that field top scale height together with all the heat, you can generate sort of a differential rotation near the surface, and that differential rotation has to be slowly eroded away by all the convection and so on. That may somehow bring the heat deeper down. However, for extrasolar planet where it's eccentricity tight, that's less clear. And I'm so carried away, I forgot what your second point is. Heat diffusion, right. Right. The thermal time scale near this region where we're putting most of the heat, it's about a couple months, and amount of heat we're putting in as a function of time, the flux of heat you're putting in, it's almost or comparable to the intrinsic heat flux coming out.
You get circulation as well, if you're at the same distance from the center, the gravity is the same, but you're from a hot spot.
Right. So, right. So the question is how hot that spot can get. And I would argue that the spot doesn't get much hotter than the surrounding, both because the heat that actually comes out is not that huge, and because the thermal time scale is sufficiently short. But we can discuss this more.
You mentioned that you typically quickly pass through the spikes where you have low Q because you dissipate energy quickly. But in some of the extrasolar Jupiters, you can imagine that they're spin synchronized as well as affecting their orbit. Is there a regime in which you can keep them in low Q for the same period of time by combining those two?
Yeah, I mean, there are theories, not directly related, saying that you could somehow trap an object in resonance for a substantial amount of time. But in this case, given how unlikely you are in the first case to fall into a very deep valley, that may not be even an important effect from the outset. Just suppose you are synchronized and you ask how likely you are already in one of these deep valleys to start with. The chance is very small already. So there's no need to worry whether it's going to be trapped in the valley afterwards or forever.
Again, it seems like you're being driven towards the rotation and forcing frequency of the
frame. One half. In the rotating frame for the eccentricity tide, the forcing frequency is at, that's right, rotation frequency. Sorry, yeah. But there's nothing special there about inertial modes at that frequency.
There still has to be dissipation going on.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, you know, what is the source of dissipation that you're assuming? I mean, how are you modeling that? Because that determines what the amplitudes you're going to get when you're in resonance. And I worry that there may be other sort of nonlinear things left out of the equations which would actually limit the amplitude before you get to what you need if you have a very low viscosity or whatever you're using.
Yeah, good point. The viscosity we're using here is turbulent viscosity because Jupiter is convective, so all the eddies presumably shear away. If you have a velocity gradient in there, the eddies tends to sort of smooth out those velocity gradient in the meantime doing sort of putting heat into the surrounding. So what we use is a mixing lens theory. So turbulent viscosity is comparable to the convective velocity times size of the convective eddies. And there's an important correction here. In fact, this correction is sort of most important for making that first theoretical estimate of Q to be 10 to the 13 instead of 10 to the 5. Well, this correction, this huge factor here, is saying that if the turbulent eddy is very small compared to the periodic forcing, it hardly feels much. It sort of averages out over a long time scale. So there's a strong suppression of the turbulent viscosity. So that's the one we used. This one can be uncertain by, I don't know how many orders of magnitude, easily factor of 10. So that's why this number I'm only taking sort of at the face value, shouldn't take at the face value, maybe a factor of 10, at least, uncertainty. And what you talk about, the nonlinear effect, I fully agree, that could well be important in the sense that, for example, the two kind of ways where I thought about it, but I haven't thought very deep, where it could be important is that first you excite these inertial modes at a certain frequency, those modes get so much energy, it maybe becomes nonlinear themselves and starts to dissipate through nonlinear damping. I hadn't thought about that. The other way is that tide can actually potentially interact with not just one inertial mode, but with two inertial modes nonlinearly, sort of, as some kind of parametric coupling. That would be another effect to be maybe worth looking into as well. But I agree, that hasn't been.
Since a lot of the damping's in the outermost parts, can you tell us a little bit about how, and you've got a lot of share in these waves, can you tell us a little bit about what you think the magnetic field will do to modifying the modes in that upper region?
Correct me if I'm wrong, I would say probably the argument there is to compare the Elfin time with the inertial mode time scale, and I have no feeling for the first time scale.
Well, the density of 10⁻³.
At that region, okay. Say, yeah, okay. Okay. So the Elfin time. Right, so the Elfin crossing time across that region sounds longer than the rotation period. Could that be possibly right?
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So I would think. Yeah, that's what I'm taking. Scale high is about 10 to 6, right? 10 to 7 kilometer at that region. Yeah. So it's depending on the field strength, it could be up to, 10 centimeters per second or something. Well, if you only modify eigenfunction in that neighborhood, it probably doesn't make a big difference to this overlap picture. And
No, not for the excitation, but just
right.
For the damping. The eigenfunction property
right.
And the amplitude up there depends on the magnetic field.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Somebody else may volunteer to calculate that. That sounds very hard to do.
I remember that in some old models of Jupiter structure, there was a region because of the opacity behavior where the there was a radiative heat transport.
Right.
And I was just wondering. I mean, I don't know if this claim still holds, but if you do have such a sort of narrow radiative zone, will you be able to excite gravity modes there and dissipate them in a pretty much the same way as Zahn's theory does for early type stars?
Yeah.
And will it give you any useful cue?
I think Lars has looked into that. Have you?
No, I.
You thought about looking into it.
I didn't do anything other than.
Right. Maybe if you looked into it. First, the radiative zone has gone away in the new calculation, new opacity calculation, and the second thing is that my first guess is not, because suppose you have a gravity mode in that tiny narrow region, the overlap between those gravity modes is very very bad. But I have not done all the management. Yeah.
I mean, there was an old thing by Mark Charlie put it in a fine run.
Right.
And then do the final damage. But it was artificial. They dialed the rest to get the field and the pond. That's the same kind of thing for other people. So that's a different kind of thing. But it didn't.
But an academic one.
There is a extrasolar path. There is a irradiated
warmth,
which does stabilize. You would have thought it only stabilizes on the day side, but it turns out even on the night side, it does depend on what the opacity is. It could also stabilize on the back side as well, although superimposed on this. Is gradient there. There is large-scale circulation. It's a little slow.
No,
it's
right.
You can look at the plume vitality frequency, and there is a layer.
Yeah, that's one of our big caveats. Suppose there is such a deep radiative atmosphere, not only the inertial modes but loses their damping region into the radiative atmosphere. Also, you can get coupling between those inertial modes with the gravity modes in those layers and lose energy that way. And I think Steve Lubow and perhaps somebody else has done. Oh, Gordon and.
Don't be bashful, Gordon.
No comment.
Well, I think the excitation of modes in the putative radiative layer is very uncertain because the models are very uncertain, and there is a calculation by Lubow et al. But when, again, if the planet is rotating, then the G modes are modified, they become some sort of half modes, and especially if there are fast zonal winds, then they're also modified by the differential rotation. This calculation hasn't really been done.
They also, in that case, get Q of order 10 to the 5, if I remember, in their calculations. Is that right? Can be, okay.
One other brief comment. In the Earth's oceans, the dissipation is actually not that well understood. And the old idea of doing all the dissipation in the shallow parts of the ocean is now known to be not correct, because Topex Poseidon data show clearly that some of the dissipation is in the deep ocean. And there, it is inertial waves, the stratification, but it has some analogies to what you're doing. And a lot of it is probably done by scattering of the waves off the bottom topography, which puts energy into other modes. But some people have talked about subharmonic parametric instabilities, and so that's another way, which is not turbulence. It involves looking at triads of waves and transferring energy from one mode into other modes, and by that way you can get a cascade, which is not Kolmogorov, but somewhat similar power law, and then you can dissipate at the small scale. So there may be a non-turbulent mechanism as well as the one you looked at.
I think that's, yeah, that's Bill's point. In fact, so there's a joke that when I first got to Canada, I was told, maybe by you, that most of the tidal dissipation on Earth occurs in Bay of Fundy.
Well, actually, it's a pretty big fraction.
That's not everything.
I would just say it's the Irish Sea.
But it happens. That's right. And in Canada, it has to be a Canadian national park, right?
Well, I suspect it's all in
California. All right, the sea kelps.
Okay, any other questions? All right, I think we're scheduled to go outside anyway, so it's a good time to stop. Let's thank our two speakers again.